The Blithedale Romance by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Chapter 23. A Village Hall. Well, I betook myself away and wandered up and down like an exorcised spirit that had been driven from its old haunts after a mighty struggle. It takes down the solitary pride of man, beyond most other things, to find the impracticability of flinging aside affections that have grown irksome. The bands that were silken once are apt to become iron fetters when we desire to shake them off. Our souls, after all, are not our own. We convey a property in them to those with whom we associate, but to what extent can never be known until we feel the tug, the agony of our abortive effort to resume an exclusive sway over ourselves. Thus, in all the weeks of my absence, my thoughts continually reverted back, brooding over the bygone months, and bringing up incidents that seemed hardly to have left a trace of themselves in their passage. I spent painful hours in recalling these trifles, and rendering them more misty and unsubstantial than at first by the quantity of speculative musing thus kneaded in with them. Hollingsworth, Zenobia, Priscilla, these three had absorbed my life into themselves. Together with an inexpressible longing to know their fortunes, there was likewise a morbid resentment of my own pain, and a stubborn reluctance to come again within their sphere. All that I learned of them, therefore, was comprised in a few brief and pungent squibs, such as the newspapers were then in the habit of bestowing on our socialist enterprise. There was one paragraph which, if I rightly guessed its purport, bore reference to Zenobia, but was too darkly hinted to convey even thus much of certainty. Hollingsworth, too, with his philanthropic project, afforded the penny-a-liners a theme for some savage and bloody-minded jokes, and considerably to my surprise, they affected me with as much indignation as if we had still been friends. Thus passed several weeks, time long enough for my brown and toil-hardened hands to reaccustom themselves to gloves. Old habits, such as were merely external, returned upon me with wonderful promptitude. My superficial talk, too, assumed altogether a worldly tone. Meeting former acquaintances who showed themselves inclined to ridicule my heroic devotion to the cause of human welfare, I spoke of the recent phase of my life as indeed fair matter for a jest. But I also gave them to understand that it was at most only an experiment on which I had staked no valuable amount of hope or fear. It had enabled me to pass the summer in a novel and agreeable way, had afforded me some grotesque specimens of artificial simplicity, and could not, therefore, so far as I was concerned, be reckoned a failure. In no one instance, however, did I voluntarily speak of my three friends. They dwelt in a profounder region. The more I consider myself as I then was, the more do I recognize how deeply my connection with those three had affected all my being. As it was already the epoch of annihilated space, I might in the time I was away from Blithedale have snatched a glimpse at England and been back again. But my wanderings were confined within a very limited sphere. I hopped and fluttered, like a bird with a string about its leg, gyrating round a small circumference and keeping up a restless activity to no purpose. Thus, it was still in our familiar Massachusetts, in one of its white country villages, that I must next particularize an incident. The scene was one of those lyceum halls of which almost every village has now its own, dedicated to that sober and pallid, or rather drab-colored mode of winter evening entertainment, the lecture. Of late years, this has come strangely into vogue when the natural tendency of things would seem to be to substitute lettered for oral methods of addressing the public. But, in halls like this, besides the winter course of lectures, there is a rich and varied series of other exhibitions. Hither comes the ventriloquist with all his mysterious tongues, the thaumaturgist, too, with his miraculous transformation of plates, doves, and rings, his pancakes smoking in your hat, and his cellar of choice liquors represented in one small bottle. Here also, the itinerant professor instructs separate classes of ladies and gentlemen in physiology, and demonstrates his lessons by the aid of real skeletons and mannequins in wax from Paris. Here is to be heard the choir of Ethiopian melodists, and to be seen the diorama of Moscow or Bunker Hill, or the moving panorama of the Chinese Wall. Here is displayed the museum of wax figures, illustrating the wide Catholicism of earthly renown by mixing up heroes and statesmen, the Pope and the Mormon prophet, kings, queens, murderers, and beautiful ladies, every sort of person, in short, except authors, of whom I never beheld even the most famous done in wax. And here, in this many-purposed hall, unless the selectmen of the village chance to have more than their share of the Puritanism which, however diversified with later patchwork, still gives its prevailing tint to New England character. Here, the company of strolling players sets up its little stage and claims patronage for the legitimate drama. But, on the autumnal evening which I speak of, a number of printed handbills stuck up in the barroom and on the signpost of the hotel and on the meeting-house porch and distributed largely through the village had promised the inhabitants an interview with that celebrated and hitherto inexplicable phenomenon, the Veiled Lady. The hall was fitted up with an amphitheatrical descent of seats towards a platform on which stood a desk, two lights, a stool, and a capacious antique chair. The audience was of a generally decent and respectable character. Old farmers in their Sunday black coats with shrewd, hard, sun-dried faces and a cynical humor, oftener than any other expression in their eyes. Pretty girls in many colored attire. Pretty young men. The schoolmaster, the lawyer or student at law. The shopkeeper. All looking rather suburban than rural. In these days, there is absolutely no rusticity except when the actual labor of the soil leaves its earth mold on the person. There was likewise a considerable proportion of young and middle-aged women, many of them stern in feature with marked foreheads and a very definite line of eyebrow, a type of womanhood in which a bold intellectual development seems to be keeping pace with the progressive delicacy of the physical constitution. Of all these people I took note, at first according to my custom, but I ceased to do so the moment that my eyes fell on an individual who sat two or three seats below me, immovable, apparently deep in thought, with his back, of course, towards me, and his face turned steadfastly upon the platform. After sitting a while in contemplation of this person's familiar contour, I was irresistibly moved to step over the intervening benches, lay my hand on his shoulder, put my mouth close to his ear, and address him in a sepulchral, melodramatic whisper. "Hollingsworth, where have you left Zenobia?" His nerves, however, were proof against my attack. He turned half around and looked me in the face with great, sad eyes, in which there was neither kindness nor resentment, nor any perceptible surprise. "Zenobia, when I last saw her," he answered, "was at Blithedale." He said no more, but there was a great deal of talk going on near me among a knot of people who might be considered as representing the mysticism, or rather the mystic sensuality, of this singular age. The nature of the exhibition that was about to take place had probably given the turn to their conversation. I heard from a pale man in blue spectacles some stranger stories than ever were written in a romance. Told, too, with a simple, unimaginative steadfastness which was terribly efficacious in compelling the auditor to receive them into the category of established facts. He cited instances of the miraculous power of one human being over the will and passions of another, insomuch that settled grief was but a shadow beneath the influence of a man possessing this potency, and the strong love of years melted away like a vapor. At the bidding of one of these wizards, the maiden, with her lover's kiss still burning on her lips, would turn from him with icy indifference. The newly made widow would dig up her buried heart out of her young husband's grave before the sods had taken root upon it. A mother, with her babe's milk in her bosom, would thrust away her child. Human character was but soft wax in his hands, and guilt or virtue only the forms into which he should see fit to mould it. The religious sentiment was a flame which he could blow up with his breath, or a spark that he could utterly extinguish. It is unutterable the horror and disgust with which I listened and saw that, if these things were to be believed, the individual soul was virtually annihilated, and all that is sweet and pure in our present life debased, and that the idea of man's eternal responsibility was made ridiculous, and immortality rendered at once impossible and not worth acceptance. but I would have perished on the spot sooner than believe it. The epoch of rapping spirits, and all the wonders that have followed in their train, such as tables upset by invisible agencies, bells self-tolled at funerals, and ghostly music performed on Jews' harps, had not yet arrived. Alas, my countrymen, methinks, we have fallen on an evil age. If these phenomena have not humbug at the bottom, so much the worse for us. What can they indicate in a spiritual way, except that the soul of man is descending to a lower point than it has ever before reached while incarnate? We are pursuing a downward course in the eternal march, and thus bring ourselves into the same range with beings whom death, in requital of their gross and evil lives, has degraded below humanity. To hold intercourse with spirits of this order, we must stoop and grovel in some element more vile than earthly dust. These goblins, if they exist at all, are but the shadows of past mortality, outcasts, mere refuse stuff, adjudged unworthy of the eternal world, and, on the most favorable supposition, dwindling gradually into nothingness. The less we have to say to them, the better, lest we share their fate. The audience now began to be impatient. They signified their desire for the entertainment to commence by thump of sticks and stamp of boot heels. Nor was it a great while longer before, in response to their call, there appeared a bearded personage in oriental robes, looking like one of the enchanters of the Arabian Nights. He came upon the platform from a side door, saluted the spectators not with a salaam, but a bow, took his station at the desk, and first, blowing his nose with a white handkerchief, prepared to speak. The environment of the homely village hall, and the absence of many ingenious contrivances of stage effect, with which the exhibition had heretofore been set off, seemed to bring the artifice of this character more openly upon the surface. No sooner did I behold the bearded enchanter than, laying my hand again on Hollingsworth's shoulder, I whispered in his ear, "Do you know him?" "I never saw the man before," he muttered, without turning his head. "But I had seen him 3 times already. Once, on occasion of my first visit to the Veiled Lady, a second time in the wood path at Blithedale, and lastly in Zenobia's drawing-room. It was Westervelt. A quick association of ideas made me shudder from head to foot, and again, like an evil spirit bringing up reminiscences of a man's sins, I whispered a question in Hollingsworth's ear. "What have you done with Priscilla?" He gave a convulsive start, as if I had thrust a knife into him, writhed himself round on his seat, glared fiercely into my eyes, but answered not a word. The professor began his discourse, explanatory of the psychological phenomena, as he termed them, which was his purpose to exhibit to the spectators. There remains no very distinct impression of it on my memory. It was eloquent, ingenious, plausible, with a delusive show of spirituality, yet really imbued throughout with a cold and dead materialism. I shivered as at a current of chill air, issuing out of a sepulchral vault and bringing the smell of corruption along with it. He spoke of a new era that was dawning upon the world, an era that would link soul to soul and the present life to what we call futurity with a closeness that should finally convert both worlds into one great, mutually conscious brotherhood. He described, in a strange philosophical guise with terms of art, as if it were a matter of chemical discovery, the agency by which this mighty result was to be effected. Nor would it have surprised me had he pretended to hold up a portion of his universally pervasive fluid, as he affirmed it to be, in a glass vial. At the close of his exordium, the professor beckoned with his hand, one, twice, thrice, and a figure came gliding upon the platform, enveloped in a long veil of silvery whiteness. It fell about her like the texture of a summer cloud, with a kind of vagueness, so that the outline of the form beneath it could not be accurately discerned. But the movement of the Veiled Lady was graceful, free and unembarrassed, like that of a person accustomed to be the spectacle of thousands, or possibly a blindfold prisoner within the sphere with which this dark earthly magician had surrounded her. She was wholly unconscious of being the central object to all those straining eyes. Pliant to his gesture, which had even an obsequious courtesy, but at the same time a remarkable decisiveness, the figure placed itself in the great chair. Sitting there, in such visible obscurity, it was perhaps as much like the actual presence of a disembodied spirit as anything that stage trickery could devise. The hushed breathing of the spectators proved how high-wrought were their anticipations of the wonders to be performed through the medium of this incomprehensible creature. I, too, was in breathless suspense, but with a far different presentiment of some strange event at hand. "You see before you the veiled lady," said the bearded professor, advancing to the edge of the platform. "By the agency of which I have just spoken, she is at this moment in communion with the spirit world. That silvery veil is, in one sense, an enchantment, having been dipped, as it were, and essentially imbued through the potency of my art with the fluid medium of spirits. Slight and ethereal as it seems, the limitations of time and space have no existence within its folds. This hall, these hundreds of faces encompassing her within so narrow an amphitheater, are of thinner substance in her view than the airiest vapor that the clouds are made of. She beholds the absolute." As preliminary to other and far more wonderful psychological experiments, the exhibitor suggested that some of his auditors should endeavor to make the veiled lady sensible of their presence by such methods, provided only no touch were laid upon her person, as they might deem best adapted to that end. Accordingly, several deep-lunged country fellows, who looked as if they might have blown the apparition away with a breath, ascended the platform. Mutually encouraging one another, they shouted so close to her ear that the veil stirred like a wreath of vanishing mist. They smote upon the floor with bludgeons. They perpetrated so hideous a clamor that, methought, it might have reached at least a little way into the eternal sphere. Finally, with the assent of the professor, they laid hold of the great chair and were startled, apparently, to find it soar upward as if lighter than the air through which it rose. But the veiled lady remained seated and motionless, with a composure that was hardly less than awful, because implying so immeasurable a distance betwixt her and these rude prosecutors. "These efforts are wholly without avail," observed the professor, who had been looking on with an aspect of serene indifference. "The roar of a battery of cannon would be inaudible to the veiled lady. And yet, were I to will it, sitting in this very hall, she could hear the desert wind sweeping over the sands as far off as Arabia, the icebergs grinding one against the other in the polar seas, the rustle of a leaf in an Indian forest, the lowest whispered breath of the bashfulest maiden in the world uttering the first confession of her love. Nor does there exist the moral inducement, apart from my own behest, that could persuade her to lift the silvery veil or arise out of that chair." Greatly to the professor's discomposure, however, just as he spoke these words, the veiled lady arose. There was a mysterious tremor that shook the magic veil. The spectators, it may be, imagined that she was about to take flight into that invisible sphere and to the society of those purely spiritual beings with whom they reckoned her so near akin. Hollingsworth, a moment ago, had mounted the platform and now stood gazing at the figure with a sad intentness that brought the whole power of his great, stern, yet tender soul into his glance. "Come," said he, waving his hand towards her. "You are safe." She threw off the veil and stood before that multitude of people, pale, tremulous, shrinking, as if only then had she discovered that 1,000 eyes were gazing at her. Poor maiden! How strangely had she been betrayed! Blazoned abroad as a wonder of the world, and performing what were adjudged as miracles in the faith of many, a seeress and a prophetess in the harsher judgment of others, a mountebank, she had kept, as I religiously believe, her virgin reserve and sanctity of soul throughout it all. Within that encircling veil, though an evil hand had flung it over her, there was as deep a seclusion as if this forsaken girl had, all the while, been sitting under the shadow of Eliot's pulpit in the Blithedale woods at the feet of him who now summoned her to the shelter of his arms. and the true heart-throb of a woman's affection was too powerful for the jugglery that had hitherto environed her. She uttered a shriek and fled to Hollingsworth like one escaping from her deadliest enemy, and was safe forever. The end of chapter 23. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.